Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In the first segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Russell Rosinskis from York University, as well as Jan Rinaldi from CDSA. Can each of you tell me a little bit about your experiences with disability rights promotion? The work you do.
Well, I guess for me, I kind of stumbled upon it. I was never really like aware of it, but it was sort of always around in my life. And when I started doing social service work, and I took this one class called Disability Discourse with someone who's actually part of CDSA now, and it just changed the whole way, I guess, I just saw the world, because disability was something that it wasn't just a group of people. It was almost, to me, it seemed like it was part of everyone. It was a whole human experience. And it became very easy for me to get behind disability rights and activism and support all the causes, because it's something that affects, I said, like pretty much everyone. That's sort of my experience. And I'm just seeing there's so many ways that you can get involved and be helpful. And, yeah.
Good. I'm affiliated with the Recounting Heronia Collective, and we work with survivors of institutionalization. And so that means that we're working with neurodivergent or intellectually disabled populations who have had histories or childhoods of being locked away in these kind of total warehousing institutional spaces, which was, for a long time, Canada's history of dealing with disability, especially intellectual disability and difference. And I think doing work with them and trying to promote their interest in narrativizing their experiences to larger audiences, it became clear that we haven't really done some of the necessary and important and difficult work around what it means to extend access and create space that accommodates for difference, whether that be physical or intellectual, especially when looking upon or looking back to the ways in which we haven't responded to disability in any way other than removing them from community space.
So why do you think society has this reluctance to embrace such people?
Sorry. I think there's a sort of a fear of, I guess part of it usually kind of there's like a fear of the unknown or a fear of a different. And I guess as humans, for some reason, there's this sort of, we kind of naturally have this natural inclination to what we use in disability studies, like make a spectacle of it stare or wonder, but not really embraced. And I guess, and the other part of it too, then, if you look back historically, right? I mean, for example, in Canada, like we're still influenced by like the Elizabethan poor laws. So this idea that we're separating people who are unable to contribute to society in a sort of, I guess, what we would now call like a neoliberal framework, right? And that becomes, and those attitudes kind of permeate through society. And then we forget to kind of think back, like reflect back at ourselves, like our cultural, like what I call like our cultural consciousness, and look back within ourselves and see, well, why are we feeling that way? Why are we thinking this about this person? Why is this the first thought that I'm thinking about this? Why are we not, you know, why where are they coming from? And yeah, I guess that's sort of like one way. I don't know if Jen has anything to add.
No, I agree. I think there's a lot of fear and uncertainty around what it means to have a disability and to talk to and deal with a disabled person. I mean, I think we see that when we talk about like when I teach assisted dying legislation in my classrooms, and students say, well, like, of course, and yes, of course, we have to think about disabled people who have a vested and persistent and rational interest in dying, but usually the knee-jerk response is, but I wouldn't want to be disabled. I think I'd rather die then. And I think a lot of that fear of disability comes from like significant misunderstanding around like stories about disability. I think we have a lot of work to do when it comes to like basic level public education around like how we include and accommodate difference in open space, because then people might be more open to difference.
So what do you think we as a society can do to start tearing down some of those myths and misperceptions?
I mean, that's a lot of the direction of disability studies right now, right? It's still kind of new, so we're trying to figure out maybe what's the most effective method. I think, like, for me personally, and part of where, like, I'm coming from more from, like, a MAD studies perspective or from, like, a mental health perspective, and I kind of think about it as, I think role modeling for me is very key, where you want to see someone who is a, you know, I guess, for example, like a Justin Trudeau, someone who would be embracing disability, but not in like this sort of like othering way, or like they're different, or what we call like the super crip way of thinking, where it's like, oh, despite your difference, you're still maintaining your place in society. You know, it would be more of this, an unconditional accepting, an unconditional kind of love, which is something that a lot of like, if you go into counseling or you get out of your, you know, it's like psychotherapy and a lot of talk therapy, is a lot of like one of the first things they tell you is it's unconditional acceptance. You're allowed to make a mistake. You're allowed to be different, and that's okay. It doesn't make you anything wrong. There's nothing. You're not messed up. You're not a bad person. It's just you. It's just who you are. And until we have that unconditional acceptance, I mean, even Justin Trudeau, I mean, some of his popularity, I believe, comes from the way he looks. And we're still, you know, that's a part of his popularity. But if he didn't look the way he did, would he be accepted the same way? And I think that's where we need to kind of work on just unconditionally accepting everyone. And I guess there's a way of role modeling into that. Is that clear?
And I'm a stuffy legal scholar, so I usually think about the sort of macro level things first. Like, we are still consulting as a community on how to build federal wide legislation for disability accommodation. And even at the provincial level, we have this sort of leading statute, our AODA, or Accessibility for Ontario Disabilities Act, that is meant to ensure access to public space and incorporate like universal design principles and accommodations in those spaces, so that people can access just like basic shopping and restaurants and education and transportation. And while we have this sort of leading document, we still don't see it implemented in really important and meaningful ways. So that takes work at sort of higher level legal levels. It also requires that we imagine how to be more responsible consumers and public like citizens, and we are more conscious of how the spaces around us aren't spaces that are always welcoming for other bodies, which means that maybe it requires like more responsible shopping choices, more responsible navigating that space as people with body privilege.
So, in your time with disability studies, what sorts of successes have you seen? Is there any case or story that stands out for you?
Sorry, can you repeat that question? You were quiet, or the phone cut.
So, in working in disability studies, is there any success story that stands out for you?
I think, I guess one for me is sort of when I was, I used to work with people with intellectual disabilities while I was finishing my master's. And I remember, you know, there's certain attitudes and beliefs in the way that these organizations work with people with intellectual disabilities. And it's not necessarily, you know, it's more treating adults as if they're children was basically the big problem. And when I was doing my master's, which was also in critical disability studies, I was able to, in my little small workplace, kind of start influencing the people around me, just, you know, subtly, just by, you know, just some of the logic and ideas that I was learning to, you know, start allowing adults to be adults, to make their own choices, but also to listen in a different way and to kind of explain, like, so some people just aren't exposed. Like, I didn't think, you know, instead of thinking my coworkers were bad workers, I was thinking of them as like, no, they just don't know. And that's different, right? And when I started saying, hey, this individual, when they get upset, they're moving, you know, their hand in a certain way, or they're looking away, or they start, you know, they make some sort of gesture. I was saying, that's not a gesture. It's not a random act. Like, it's kind of like language. So what I kind of had them, we kind of started recording these different gestures and ways that they were moving, and kind of started learning to speak their language. So they'd be able to communicate, I'm being upset, I maybe need some time alone, and things like that. And to me, just to change that one little small space where I think we had, like, we worked with 20 to 25 individuals, I think that would be, like, a kind of a success story of sorts.
And I think, I think there are a lot of success stories to be found in our, like, ground-level activist movement in disability advocacy work. Like, I'm just always floored by the, like, sort of tireless efforts we work at, yeah, like, with, like, seeking recognition or, like, instigating social change. So when Jeff Preston, like, wheelchairs around Ontario in some kind of, like, freedom tour, or, like, Patricia Seth and Marie Clark won a class action lawsuit for the institutional violences they experienced due to statewide negligence. And that was a multi-million-dollar settlement that triggered a whole rash of lawsuits that survivors have taken to court to, like, wage their own, like, build their own success stories, I suppose. So I think it's not a hard thing to see that we're, like, a community full of success stories.
Yeah.
I think we just don't tell those stories enough.
So, if each of you could send any one message about the need for equality and representation, what would it be?
I think it would be, I mean, my big thing is maybe just stop and listen and then think about what you're hearing before you act. I think we're kind of caught up we're kind of moving too fast in our society, and I think we just need to stop and listen and stop speaking and just listen and figure and really, like, think about what we're hearing.
Good. Yeah. And in that spirit, I'd say equality is never one size fits all. Equality is better construed as equity. People achieve equality when their difference is acknowledged. And representation is best done when you have the persons you are representing at the table and in the room.
I'd like to thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
Sure, thanks.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
To help celebrate Rendez-vous de la Francophonie, 50 campus and community radio stations from across Canada produced radio documentaries highlighting Rendez-vous de la Francophonie events, the importance of bilingualism, and Francophone history and culture in Canada. The RBF series is brought to you by La Fondation Canadienne pour le Dialogue des Cultures in partnership with the National Campus and Community Radio Association, Canadian Heritage, and this station. For more information, check out www.ncra.ca/RBF.
Welcome back to HandyLink. sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Russell Rosinskis from York University and Jen Rinaldi from CDSA. This segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Landon Penner from Adaptabilities. So tell me a little bit about Adaptabilities.
Yeah, so Adaptabilities is a nonprofit organization in Edmonton, Alberta. We support individuals with special needs. So we support both children and adults with special needs. We want to empower families to grow, succeed, and belong. That is our vision. Adaptabilities was founded in 2004, so 13 years ago, and it was built out of gaps in the system. So when there was gaps in the system, our executive director, Michelle Hurdell, came up with solutions for those gaps. So she was an adapted phys ed teacher in one of the schools in Edmonton, and she noticed that kids were being kicked out of daycares, being kicked out of camps because of the special needs that they had, and they required some extra attention. So the staff weren't trained at these other camps or daycares. They were being kicked out, and their families had nowhere for them to go when they needed support. So Michelle actually opened up her family home and allowed these kids to come in, and she developed programming for them during this time. That was 13 years ago. And within those 13 years, we have three centers now. We have an in-home program where we go to families' houses if they need us to, and we also have summer camps that run as well. So the first year she was running summer camps, there were four kids registered in summer camps a week, and now we have over 100 kids and adults registered per week in summer camps.
So are there any challenges in running programs such as these?
I think there's always challenges that are faced in running any program for anyone. One thing that we really focus on is self-care, so it's important for staff to have self-care. It's also important for families to have self-care during these programs because we need to prevent caregiver burnout for families as well. So I think that's one of the challenges, just making sure that everyone's taking care of themselves and no one's getting burnt out during the programming.
So how do you go about spreading the word about the work you do?
So we are a very young organization in Edmonton, but word spreads very quickly in Edmonton because it's a tight-knit community, the community in Edmonton of special needs. So lots of times it's just word of mouth for families. So families are talking to each other about different programs that are in Edmonton. We also attend many trade fairs. Our HR department goes to career fairs where people hear about us. So we're out in the community developing those relationships. Our adult program, we actually have a program called Community Connect, where the adults are out in the community every day doing volunteer work, doing employment, building life skills. So they're actually making those connections themselves as well and building those natural supports, which is great for them in the community. Another thing that Adaptabilities does is inclusive kid zones. So we have developed some different activities. So there we have some bubble suits, and we have some different arcade games, and we have like giant bingo and giant checkers, and we take those to different events in the city that are happening, so events that draw thousands and thousands of people in, and we call it Inclusive Kids Zone. So any child with any ability or any background are allowed to come in and just have fun and play for free with each other.
So in your time with Adaptabilities, is there any success moment that stands out for you?
Yeah, so I think at Adaptabilities, there's so many successful stories that we have that, you know, we celebrate successes every single day. So when we have an meeting, we always talk about every success that has happened because we want to celebrate all wins at Adaptabilities. To pick out one success story, I think, so this one time we were supporting this family, and they were struggling with their daughter who has a special need, and she was becoming violent and she was becoming aggressive, and it was really tearing the family apart. And, you know, we were able to change some of the supports that we were providing for her, and we went in-home with that family. A staff went there every day to just support her in getting up and really making a difference. And the family came back to us within a week's time, and they were in tears just saying that the father, he was so grateful for us. He was in tears, and he was just like, you know what, you guys actually saved my life. You guys were able to allow me to keep my job, because if I stay home and support my daughter through these challenging behaviors, I wouldn't be able to keep my job, and our family would be at risk of losing our home. So I think that was one moment that I was like, wow, like, what we're doing is actually making a difference in people's lives.
So, are there any projects on the horizon for Adaptabilities?
Yeah, so we're constantly growing organically. So because our program started as children programming, but those children grow up into adults, and adults still need support, we've kind of grown our adult world a little more. So as time goes on, the children keep turning into adults, the more children that we take in. The adult program is definitely growing organically. So we're always looking to and ways and new spaces to find for our adult programming. So I think that's one area that we're growing in. We're also really focusing on how can we make our programs more inclusive, and how can we make people so they don't need programming? How can we support people to be independent in their lives so that they don't need as many staff helping them to achieve the goals that they want to achieve? So one thing that we're working on for the coming year is a transit program. So it's basically to help teenagers who have special needs take transit independently so that they don't need to use resources from the city of Edmonton to help them take transit. So we're developing a program just to help teenagers, so age 14 to 17, get the skills to use transit by themselves. So if they have a job, they can go to the job on their own. Lots of jobs require people to get there by themselves. So it's a really important skill for everyone to learn how to take transit by themselves.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Such a simple message, folks, but such a meaningful one. Just listen. Listen to the needs, the stories, the voices of individuals with disabilities. Take the time to find out who they really are, what really matters to them, before you decide that you know everything, before you decide that one article that may or may not have all the information is gospel. Just because you heard from one source that a person with a disability is mentally incapable or should be shunned away from society does not make it true. Subject that Jen mentioned of institutional treatment. This is a big one for me, folks. Fact is, there's no justification for ever abusing a person with a disability, regardless of what that disability may be. But for somebody with mental health issues or psychological problems, the ability to defend themselves against such things might not be there. Society should always look first and ask, are we meeting the needs of the most vulnerable members of society? Or the perceived most vulnerable members of society, I should say. Because individuals with disabilities, despite being people of strength and character and capability, are often misperceived, misunderstood as people who should be locked away or shied away from, or who need way more support than they actually do. I've talked about it before, the principle of scaffolding, which is giving a person the help they need, but not assuming because they have difficulty with one thing that they need help with this, this, and this. Let a person try. Let a person be a part of society. If they're not allowed to be in the greater world, how are they supposed to know anything about it? How are they supposed to be a part of what happens? That's really where institutions and isolation become a big problem for me, folks. If you take a person out of what we consider functional society, how are they supposed to know what's expected of them in the world for the day when they return? And what's worse, how are those around us supposed to have any firsthand or meaningful information what it's like to deal with a person with a disability? You can't listen to their story if you're unwilling to hear it, if you're unable to hear it, for that matter. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, the numeral 4, gmail.com. Always love to hear from you folks at home. What Russell was saying in his part of the interview, it amazed me, folks. It amazed me to hear someone would actually take the time to learn the gestures, to learn the nonverbal cues of people with disabilities, to understand what full communication really is, to understand why people respond the way they do. If we can take these little steps forward, we can build a bridge of understanding. Brick by brick, layer by layer, we can come to understand what disability life truly is, what it truly means. Assumptions and misperceptions aside, we do have the potential to grow as a people, to become something so much more. Sometimes, my friends, I ask myself a simple question. What does it take to change minds, hearts, when it comes to people with disabilities? The answer, several things. It takes commitment, which any organization would always say they have. But the proof is in the effort they put in. It takes heart, real passion, real love for what you're doing. I hear this best when people say, we want to work ourselves out of existence. We want to see the day that there'll be no need to push for equal rights, when equality will simply be just there because it's assumed that every human being has something to contribute and is capable. It takes vision for the future, too, you know. I always love hearing when an organization has plans on the horizon. They want to do more and more to open the eyes. Some of what Jen was saying about how she teaches her students. She talked to me a little bit about some of the more progressive issues that she likes to work in. She mentioned, in particular, a story from a while back, wherein I interviewed a transgendered person who was denied certain access because people perceive things the wrong way. But I was glad to hear that she was interested in this story, because disability organizations must be open to and aware of what some of the other issues are. Disability rights, they're constantly evolving. They're constantly coming into question. What is equal representation? What is the right amount of access? True, disability is not a one-size-fits-all. There is no universally accessible solution. But if individuals and organizations keep pushing forward, if they keep asking the question, what can I do to make things as accessible as possible? Eventually, progress is made. Lives are bettered. The fact is, there is no human being without potential, without the capability to succeed, learn, love, grow, create. Truth is, the best, most committed disability organizations are the ones that are always asking the question, what next? How do we expand? How do we create more? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.